Good to see you all again this morning. Thank you, Mark, and a special thanks to Mark and Marty who got us back online. Turned out just to be an inadvertent, I think, bump of a switch, but that's all it takes, so it wasn't anything serious in terms of the PowerPoint. I hope you all had a good night's sleep. This is a slide of how men sleep before they're married. We don't normally think in the church of a generational gap, and as I observe meetings like this, I see the younger people talking with the older people and vice versa, and I think that's one of the great strengths of the church. But there are generational gaps. Now, don't anybody need to blurt this out, but raise your hand if you know who this is. I said don't blurt it out. Okay. If you know who that is, you're probably over 50, or close to it. That's Kirby Grant, better known to those of us on Saturday mornings as Sky King. But if I put that downstairs, or if I was with young people, I could put that up for about 100 years, and they'd just look at me, just like I would look at them if they put up a picture of, what is it, Snoopy Dog or Snoopy Doo or something. I don't know who that is. But in the Lord, we're all together, aren't we? But I make this point that when we talk about worldviews, there is, without really intending for there to be, a generational gap. If you're over 50, you view the world differently than if you're 20. People that are 20, because you were taught differently. You were exposed to different things. So we just need to keep that in mind as we go through this. Just a brief, get us back to where our main focus is. We're talking about Satan's attack on society and on the church, and we've talked about how worldviews, which are shaped by our religion, our philosophy, our friends, our media, our environment, our education, they lead to our beliefs, our values, and ultimately to our behavior. That being the case, I think behavioral problems find their roots in some of these that are below it. They don't all start with a wrong worldview. You can have a theistic worldview and still have poor behavior because there are different fragments of theistic worldviews. But I just want us to keep that in mind as we go through this. I'm not going to go back and share with you those slides that you lost, even though they were magnificent. But I did want to go back and capture this last thought. A couple of the elders thought since my PowerPoint went off that I should start back where I was Monday morning and go through the whole week. But I didn't sense a lot of support for that from within the assembly, so we won't do that. But one of the points I was making as we were closing yesterday is modern thought tries to feel, then to know, and then to do. We are a very feeling-oriented society, and our feelings largely guide us. Feelings are important. But often in that process, Christ gets left out, and therein lies obviously a momentous problem. Christianity, and this is a subtle but a very, I think, important difference, tries to know, then feel, and then do. In other words, our feelings come from our learning of the truth rather than our truth coming from the learning of our feelings. And it, I think, is very important that our biblical worldview is anchored in the truth, the Bible, which then leads to feelings. Sometimes we in the Church of Christ are maybe criticized, and with some appropriateness for not having enough emotion in our services. And it's been alluded to, Eric and his amens and so forth, and that's fine. I just wasn't raised that way, so it's not my normal habit. I don't have a problem with it. I kind of enjoy it when people do it. But our religions around us are, at least in the Protestant denominations around us, are so emotionally geared that emotion or feelings often takes precedence over knowledge. And that is certainly a problematic issue. True Christianity, even as having said that, goes beyond knowing, it goes beyond feeling, and I believe it needs to go even beyond doing. It needs to take us to being. You can know, you can feel, you can do, and still not be a Christian. Because Christianity is the development of a being. Now, if we are a being in a Christian sense, we will know, feel, and do. But I think those are important aspects for us to keep in mind as we consider the worldview. What I want to do in this hour is discuss what's commonly called the problem of evil and pain. This is probably my favorite session, not because it's necessarily more important. I just find it intellectually stimulating to go through some of these thoughts. And I know some or many of you have probably worked your way through what is called the problem of evil or the problem of pain and suffering. And you may have come to a little different slant on it than I have, and I will welcome that. But what I'm going to do is share with you my belief, my reconciliation, if you will, regarding this issue of the problem of evil and pain. Well, what is the problem of evil and pain? It is nothing new. You can go back to the book of Job, but you find fragments of the problem of pain and suffering and evil, and that's probably at least 4,000 years old. But in the 3rd century B.C., Epicurus wrote this. He asked, "Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Well, if he is, then he's not omnipotent. Is he able to prevent evil but not willing to do it? Well, if that's the case, then he's malevolent or just bad. Is God both able and willing to prevent evil? If that's the case, then why do we have evil? Is God neither able nor willing to prevent evil? If that's the case, why do we call him God?" And what he was getting at was the issue of how do you reconcile a loving, omnipotent, all-powerful God with the calamities that we see? Sam Harris, who is not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination, in a letter to the Christian Nation in 2006, wrote this. "This is an age-old problem of theodicy," and it is an age-old problem, all the way back to Job, and probably maybe even earlier than Job, but in writings it goes clear back to Job. "This is an age-old problem of theodicy. Of course, we should consider it solved. If God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the egregious calamities that we see, or he does not care about them. God, therefore, is either impotent or evil. If God can't stop all of the pain and suffering and evil in the world, then he's not all-powerful. If he can stop it and just chooses not to do it, then he's evil." Very similar to what we saw Epicurus at least asking about. And I think those are legitimate questions. And legitimate questions deserve legitimate answers. It was C.S. Lewis, and I'm going by memory here, but I think in one of his writings he says, "Nothing is more frustrating than a well-stated question without a well-thought-out answer." And I think there's truth to that. I believe this question is legitimate. I believe it is an issue that we as Christians ought to certainly resolve in our own minds, but be able to resolve it in the minds of others as it comes up. Now, in Sam Harris's quote, he mentioned the concept of theodicy, which I thought I would take just a one bullet here to define what theodicy is. Theodicy is the branch of theology that defends God's goodness and justice in the face of the existence of evil. It's the study or the branch of theology that wrestles with this problem that we're talking about. And I think it may, in many senses, be man's most daunting question. At least it's one of man's most daunting questions. I don't know if I would say it's... there's some daunting questions. I don't know how to rate them, but it certainly is near the top of the list. And it is a very emotional issue. And many of us, many of you, if not all of us, have had emotional times in our lives where we really struggle with this. Dan Barker, in the Barker-Butts debate, which was just within the last few months, made this statement. All you have to do is walk into a children's hospital and you know there is no God. Now what was he talking about? He was talking about children with cancer, children with birth defects, beautiful little children that weren't going to be able to make it to their next birthday. And he was saying, your God of the Bible, how could he allow this? He couldn't, so he must not exist. And it is an emotional thing. I don't know that anybody here would go to the extent of making this statement, but I'm sure there are those of us here who have sometimes said, how does this fit into the God I read about in the Bible? How in the world could this happen? When I was growing up, well, that's an assumption. When I was younger, and I was in my 20s, and some of you will remember this young man. He was my age in Kansas City. I had moved to Kansas City after I got out of college. His name was Doug Phillips. Very talented. I mean, he had more talent in one finger than I've got in eight centuries. He died in his 20s. And I remember asking myself, I didn't really question, was there a God? I just said, why? I mean, come on. He could do so much more than I could do. Why didn't you take me? Well, I didn't really want to go, but it was a puzzlement to me. Well, the answer to it is probably time and chance. But haven't you ever wondered why? I've seen grandparents lose grandchildren and they wonder, why didn't they take me? I'm old as opposed to young. Well, there aren't always answers. There usually aren't answers to those things. But they do make us ask these questions. How could God maybe not cause it, but how could he allow it? You might remember, I don't remember if it was yesterday or the day before, I spent some time on the will of God and is God's will always done? Well, that was partially in response to a question I got, but it was also partially in preparatory to this session. Because if you take the position, or somebody takes the position, that God's will is always done, then you've got a real problem with this. You got a real problem, because then you have to explain why God wanted to take that little baby. Why God wanted to take Doug Phillips. Why God wanted... Everything comes under the why God wanted it to happen. Well, as I said in that, I don't think God's will is always done. In fact, I don't think God's will is usually done in an action sense. It is done in a purpose sense, but not in an action sense. But there are inconsistencies, and we're going to come back to the issue here that many of these things, once we think about them and once we work our ways through them, do fall on their weight of their own illogic. For instance, if a plane goes down and 100 people die, we ask, how could God allow that to happen? And I wondered that. How could God allow that to happen? But if man aborts tens of thousands of babies, we call it our moral right. Now that's an ironic inconsistency. The loss of life is much greater in the second portion, and yet we don't, as a nation, as a society, ascribe that to why did God let that happen? Whereas if only a few die, in a tragic sense, that is often the case. But we can bring that back home. Many of you have been in hospital waiting rooms when a loved one or a loved one of somebody you love died. Maybe it's a brother in the church and you're there when their parent or their mate or their child dies. And it's not terribly uncommon for someone to say in that moment of grief, How could God let this happen? Or why did God cause this to happen? It's not terribly uncommon for us in our poorer moments of comfort to go up to somebody and say, well, it was God's will, and God has a purpose. Well, that may be occasionally true, but I don't find that to be terribly good comfort. And it's probably a little dangerous in that we blame God for things that we shouldn't be blaming God for, because it wasn't His intent in the first place. If things had moved as God had hoped they would move, there wouldn't be any death. There wouldn't be any disease. But of course we know there is. But still we're left with this issue. How can this world, with all of its calamity, with all of its pain, with all of its suffering, be allowed by God, even if He doesn't cause it? And I think maybe this is intensified in our day and time, because we see, vis-a-vis CNN, Fox, cable TV, satellite TV, we see all so many more calamities that our great-grandparents saw. Maybe they'd see somebody die every other year. Maybe they'd chop off a finger every other year. We see starving children. The pictures are on our TV, and you say, how can this happen? Somebody kills their baby in California or in South Carolina. We know it by about the time anybody knows it. We're just bombarded with evil and pain because that sells. Probably says something about nature. You know, people will always say, oh, that's awful, I don't want to watch it, but we do watch it. It's like soap operas. I've never found anybody who says, I don't watch soap operas, but somebody watches them because they've been on for 60 years. I want to begin with a verse in Matthew chapter 6, verse 13. Okay, what's happening in Matthew chapter 6, verse 13? I did this in Acts chapter 17, and you got an A. What? Sermon on the Mount, more specifically? Okay, the model prayer. And in the model prayer, we call it the Lord's Prayer, which is probably not its best terminology, but we'll leave Wade to work us through that here, I think, next week. But in Matthew chapter 6, verse 13, there's two interesting phrases. I call it 13a and 13b. First of all, in that passage, Jesus says, lead us not into temptation. Well, that's a request that we not be led into temptation. Well, temptation takes their various forms. Sometimes it's a test of loyalty. I think in Genesis 22, when Abraham was told to go sacrifice Isaac, that was a test of loyalty. Sometimes it's a trap. In Matthew chapter 4, Satan was trying to trap Jesus. Sometimes it can lead us into sin. 1 Corinthians 7:5 is talking about the marriage relationship, and there it says, don't defraud yourself from your mate, lest you be tempted to sin. Sometimes it's an issue of strength of our faith. James chapter 1, verses 2, 3, and 4 talk about those trials, those temptations, if you will, that come. I think many times the same thing comes to us, maybe in the form of a godly sent thing or a satanic sent thing, but the purpose is different. If God brings something to my life that's hard, He's doing it to help me get stronger. If Satan brings something into my life that is hard or puts me in front of something hard, he's doing it to try to break me down. But the issue here in verse 13 that I really wanted to look at was the second phrase. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Christ felt it was important enough to at least interject this concept of being delivered from evil that he put it in this very short prayer. It just takes 30 seconds to utter or read or recite this particular prayer. And I think he did it for a multiplicity of reasons, and I've listed three. One, he's emphasizing the danger of our human situation. We are in danger. And so he says, you need to pray that you are delivered from these dangers, the danger of evil. It's also a recognition of the inadequacy of our human resources. If I could deliver myself from evil, why would I need to pray about it? The fact is, I can't by myself, on my own, deliver myself from evil. So I need help. He that is in me is greater than he that is without. Whoops, pardon me. And secondly, maybe a parcel of that, it is a recognition of the weakness we have. We need help. And the Bible talks much about educating us and being there to help us. But Christ is admitting or reminding us that evil is an issue. It is an issue that we have to deal with. It's an issue that we have to recognize. And it is an issue that has to be addressed in all of our lives if we're going to be the children of God. So now I come to what I'm called the argument or the problem of evil. And I know that for some of you, I hope for most of you, but at least for some of you, you've gone through this. But I'm sure that many of us have not gone through this, and it needs to be gone through. And the younger people, you will have to work your way through this if you are going to have a successful Christian walk. I think that's true of the older people to some extent, but sometimes older people have lived their way so long that you can almost live it without thought. And I'm not sure that's good, but I'm sure that does occur. I believe this is the atheist's best argument. Now, that's my opinion. But if I were an atheist and wanted to convince people that God doesn't exist, this would be my number one tool, and I think it's Satan's number one tool in terms of developing deviant worldviews. And it essentially is this, and I've alluded to it in some of the quotes, but the argument or the problem of evil is, if God is all-powerful and all-good, how could he allow evil to exist? Therefore, your God, the God of the Bible, must not exist, because evil exists, and it is totally incompatible with the God you're trying to make me believe. I believe this is Satan's attack on the theistic worldview. Now, as I go through these next slides, it's sometimes hard to give credit for our sources, but there's been a lot of people work on this problem. You know, obviously Epicurus was working on it, Augustine worked on it. More recently, the C.S. Lewis's, the Rabbi Zacharias's, and various people, modern-day apologetics, have worked on it. One man that his organization of this I found very helpful, and so I'm just going to pass it along to you, is a man by the name of Norman Geisler. He's written several books. But one book in particular he wrote, and it's entitled, If God, Why Evil? In other words, if there's a God, why is all this evil? Now, Norman Geisler is a theist. He believes in God. He's probably in his 80s now. He's been associated with some colleges in the Southeast. He doesn't promote what denomination he's with. I'm pretty sure it's not Church of Christ. He calls himself a modified Calvinist. But when I went back and read what he believed about Calvinism, it was almost exactly what I believe. So I don't consider him a Calvinist, but I think he probably calls him, in my opinion, a modified Calvinist, because that's more politically correct if you're trying to sell books than calling yourself a non-Calvinist. But I find him rather conservative in his theology. I'm sure I don't agree with all of his theology, but I wanted to note that and give credit, if that's the right word, or give you a resource. If you read his books and listen to his lectures, I hope you find things, as I did, that I don't agree with, so I'm trusting you to be discerning in terms of the wheat and the chaff. I hate to even recommend any author in any book other than God and the Bible, but sometimes there are resources that can be helpful. There are really three basic responses to the issue of the problem of evil, and it depends upon your worldview. Now, you could pick modified worldviews and get modified responses, but to keep it rather simple, and a lot of this is in your notebook. I probably put this next set of slides in your notebook probably as thoroughly as anything I put in there. Pantheism. Remember pantheism? It believes that God is in everything. God is in all. Pantheism affirms that God exists, but it tends to deny evil and pain. Charles Engel was asking me, or we were talking the other day, if God is in everything and evil exists, then God is in evil and evil is in God. Well, that's the problem that a pantheism has. Therefore, they tend to deny the reality of pain and evil, and they talk of them as illusions. An example of that that maybe here in the United States we're most familiar with would be like some of the writings of Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of the Christian Science group, that tends to reject physical medicine. And that's one of their issues. And part of that is based upon the fact that pain and illness is somewhat illusionary. Now, that's not their whole concept. Some of them, sometimes they just say, well, your faith can overcome it. But they tend to affirm God exists, but then in order to put that together, they deny that pain and evil exist. Well, obviously, I think we would have a problem with that because we hurt. I mean, when I'm hurting, don't tell me that pain is illusionary. Don't tell Christina that her back pain was illusionary. It hurt. I don't know if she's here. There she is. She took medicine to mask it, I guess, for want of a better phrase, and she's back with it. But I'd hate to go up and try to tell her that's not real. I remember, and I've told some of you this story, but it's so classic. When I was coaching Little League Baseball, sometimes, and especially in T-ball, this kid would get hit in the face with a ball. I love Lonnie in Newcastle. What's his last name? Lonnie McClintock. He has a great definition of T-ball. You put the tee on the ball, you hit it, and all, it's like the Red Sea. It parts, all the kids go this way, and then when the ball quits, all the kids come back and grab it. Well, I was teaching T-ball, and some little kid hit this ball and hit this kid right smack in the face. And they came in another 45 minutes when we finally got the team out. And I said, he said, he was hurt. I said, now you can hurt later. We got a game to play. And he said, Coach, it hurts. I don't care what you say. It hurts. And he was right. So I kind of quit using that. It wasn't Wade, although Wade was on some of my teams. It hurts. It is. Pain is real. Now, there are mental aspects to pain. And some of you have a greater tolerance to pain because of some mental capacity. I never thought of myself as having a great tolerance to pain, but I think I must, because there's been several times they've said, you need to be in the hospital, and I said, no, I didn't, and I walked out, and I'm still here, because it just didn't hurt. And this concept of pain being an illusion, where did that illusion come from? And what really strikes me is if pain is illusion, we're all having the same illusion. And that seems terribly coincidental. I mean, I can have an illusion, and you can have an illusion, but all of us have the same one at the same time? Well, that's the pantheistic problem with this. Atheism, they deny God, but they affirm pain and evil. And it is pain and evil that is probably their strongest argument that God doesn't exist. So that's the way they work through it. C.S. Lewis, who was one of many people, as you know, who was an atheist and then tried to disprove Christianity and converted to Christianity, and I'm using the term Christianity in a broad sense, and we do use that term far too broadly. We talk about this Christian writer and that Christian writer. Well, they may be theistic, but they're not. Most of them aren't Christian, as I understand Christian. Having said that, he wrote, "My argument was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of what a straight line is. I could have got my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own, but if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed also, end quote. What he was saying is he at one time looked at the world and said, this is unjust. It is not fair. But if you call something unjust and unfair, you have to have a standard of justice and fairness with which to gauge it again in order to call it unfair and unjust. And he said, I realized, where did my standard of fairness and justice come from? We'll talk a little bit more about that. The statement that the world is not just demands that one knows what just is. And if there is a moral law that defines what just is, there must also be a moral lawgiver. And now we're on our way to beginning to understand, or I think, explain this. But before I get to that, theism is the worldview that affirms both God and evil exist. And we have both. To me, that's by far the most logical position. Irregardless of faith, that's just basic logic. We know that evil does exist. In fact, I think evil and pain cry out for God. This is a classic example of the very thing that one worldview would use to say God doesn't exist actually proves that he does. And we'll work our way through that, at least as I understand it and as works best for me. Evil and pain cry out for God to, number one, explain how we know what evil is. If you do not have a moral lawgiver, you do not have a moral law. If you do not have a moral law, you don't know what right and wrong or good and evil is, because you have no standard by which to define them. I think evil and pain cry out because it requires us, we have this inner need to be comforted in our sorrow over evil. Who does someone who doesn't believe in God go to for comfort? I don't know. I mean, they might go to someone they know, but that's a pretty temporal, shallow thing. Where do we go? We go to the Lord, don't we? He's our rock. I think pain and evil also cry out for God because that is what gives us that great hope and understanding of victory over evil. But there are still some problems that I think are important for us to address. And maybe I'm just now going back and dissecting this in a little bit more detail. My approach to thorny problems is look at the big problem and then start peeling layers off, and you get more specific with each layer. And that's my scientific background, but that's just the way I kind of peel things off. There is a problem here that believers, I think, have to be able to address. And this is the problem. God is all good, and God opposes evil. True or false? True. No. If that's not true in your head, you see me or one of us, because that's what we call a slam dunk in Missouri. I don't know what you call it up here. God is all-knowing, and he foreknew evil. True. When Satan fell, that didn't surprise God. He knew it was going to happen. When Adam and Eve sinned, that did not surprise God. He knew it was going to happen. That's what I believe foreknowledge is all about, as it's talked about in Ephesians chapter 1. Now, I'm getting a little above my pay grade, because to really grasp how someone can know what's going to happen and not be a causal effect of what's going to happen, that gets us up into God's stratosphere. But I believe that's where God is. I believe God knows which one of us are going to be saved. But he doesn't cause that. Now that's a real hard issue for a lot of people. If God knows whether I'm going to be saved or not, why should I even do anything, because it's already predetermined? No, it's not predetermined. It's pre-known. And there is a difference. God God is all-powerful, and therefore he can defeat evil. True statement. So God is all good, he's all knowing, he's all powerful, but we still have evil. Now what's going on? How can this be? How can the God that you and I believe, does this work? How can the God that you and I believe that has all of these characteristics be compatible with point number four? That's the dilemma. And unthought out, it can stop a believer in their tracks when you're having a discussion with somebody. Why does God, at a minimum, allow evil and pain? I'm not even saying that he causes it. At a minimum, how does he allow it? And he certainly does allow it, or it wouldn't be here, because he could wipe it away. So you've got to at least admit he allows it. At least I think you do, to be intellectually honest. And sometimes our arguments with people that don't share our belief are not necessarily intellectually honest. But I think we need to be intellectually honest. Let's talk a little bit about, if you'll allow me, and I guess you have no choice, your choice is whether you stay or not, to talk about the nature of evil. And this is really the issue. Did God create evil? Now, I don't want you to answer me out loud. Just ponder that for a minute. How would you answer that question? Did God create evil? Well, didn't God create all things? Evil is something. Therefore, God created evil. Some of you aren't buying that, and some of you are going this. Well, I don't buy it. But that is the argument. And it's a pretty logical argument. You mean God didn't create all things? You mean evil isn't something? Come on. Now you're pulling my leg. So God had to create evil. Well, I don't believe that to be a true statement, but how do we teach our young people? How do we teach people we're talking to that don't have a theistic worldview? How do we discuss this? Well, that's what I want to talk about now, that I'm going to call the response. I believe the response is, I don't believe evil is a thing. And therein lies the key. And this was probably, as I worked my way through this whenever, and I go back and work my way through it periodically because I'll get a little fuzzy or wonder if I've missed something. This was probably the hardest hurdle for me to intellectually get over. And it may be the hardest hurdle for you to get over, and it may be a hurdle that you don't accept. That's fine. We're still brothers and sisters. But I think we need to challenge ourselves maybe more than we do. I believe evil is a corruption of a good thing. And that is different than being a thing. I did a little bit, just this little segment I did in my college age class at Eminence. And boy, they were very attentive, and I had numerous questions about it. You know, the Bible says, abstain from evil. Well, if evil's not a thing, what are we doing? Well, those are very valid questions. But I believe evil is a corruption of a good thing. Evil is not a thing. It is a lack of a good thing. Now, bear with me here. And again, I want you to agree with me, but I don't demand that. I just want us to think. Okay? Okay, we got 15 minutes. We'll get through this part of it. We do have 15, yeah. Since evil is not a thing, God did not create evil, because I don't believe evil was created. Now, what are you saying? We've got evil. Now you're saying it's not created. Well, bear with me a little bit here, and we'll talk about a little bit. God made only good things. I don't know if I got that on. Yeah. God made only good things. Genesis chapter 2. He created it, he looked at it, and he said it was all good. Okay. I didn't last, because we get to Genesis 3, and it's not, things aren't all good. But in Genesis chapter 2, he's done creating, and it says it was all good. I think evil is a little bit like rot on a tree. It's like rust to metal. It's a little bit like moth holes, and I don't know that we have moth holes too much anymore with our modern fabrics, but Grandma and Grandpa, they'd have moth holes in their sweaters, shirts. What do you call a sweater that is totally moth-eaten? You call it a hanger, because that's all's left. It's nothing. It's gone. What do you call a car that is completely rusted? You call it a brown spot on the driveway, because the car's gone. Now, I know all these physical metaphors do have their limits, but I think we've got some non-physical metaphors that we can also look at. What day did God create light? First day. What day did he create darkness? He didn't. Because he separated it. But what is darkness? It is the absence of light. Darkness is not a thing. It is the absence of a good thing. Those of us, and the younger people will have an advantage. We talk about hot and cold. Hot is a thing. Cold is not a thing. Cold is the absence of heat. So when we put something in the refrigerator, we are not adding cold to it. We are removing heat, because cold is not a thing. Heat's the thing. It gets cold because you slow down the molecular movement of whatever you're cooling, and it feels cold. Blindness. You don't create blindness. Blindness is the absence of sight. Now, there are things that can cause you to lose your sight. I very much understand that, and some of us are losing our sight in varying degrees. My point is, God set this universe up so there are numerous things that aren't things, but rather are the absence of things. And I believe evil is the absence of good. So when Satan fell, he really did something that was less good, and that is evil. When Adam and Eve sinned, they did something that was less good than what God had told them to do, and that's sin. When I sin, I do what is less good. Now, I know you can sit there and you may be thinking, well, we're into linguistic and mental gymnastics. Well, yes, we are to some extent, but I think there are important gymnastics. So if God did not create evil, where did it come from? Good question. Well, the claim is God is absolutely perfect. I don't want to argue that. God did not create anything that was imperfect, at least on this world, Genesis chapter 2. And how can a perfect creature, or a perfect creature, cannot produce evil? So now we've got everything's good. So how can everything good result in evil? Tis a predicament. What was that? Oh, there was an old TV show. I don't know if any of you ever saw. You got to be really old. The Life of Riley. And in The Life of Riley, he would say, "This is a revolting development." Well, that's kind of the way I feel as I go down through. This is a kind of a revolting development. How could that work? And evil cannot arise in this world because perfect can't result in something that's imperfect. Now again, that's the argument, not a bad one. But I think we can respond. First of all, and this isn't really the ultimate response to it, but evil did not originate in this world. Evil originated when Satan rebelled against God in heaven. So if the argument is evil couldn't originate in this world, well, you don't have to rebut that, because a biblical worldview doesn't believe that evil did originate in this world. But that does not answer the question. God still only created good things. But one of the good things that God created was what we call free will. Free will is a good thing. You ever wish God had made you a robot so that you couldn't do anything bad? Well, that's one of those questions I think you've got two choices. You can either say yes or lie. I think probably at some point all of us have thought, wouldn't it be good if I could just never do anything bad and therefore God would always be happy with me? Well, that's not the life that we live, is it? Because we're human beings. God created goodwill, free will, pardon me, but free will is a good thing. Free will, a good thing, makes evil possible, since free will is the power to do otherwise. Okay? Free will is a good thing, but it does make evil possible, since by definition, free will is the power to do other than good. If it's not the power to do other than good, then it's not really free will. We're robotic. So man could do evil. God didn't make man do evil. God didn't create evil. But when God gave free will, by its very definition, he made evil possible. And this is probably really the crux of this part of my presentation. I believe God made evil possible by giving us free will, but man, or Lucifer, prior to that, made evil actual when he chose the lesser good. Adam and Eve brought sin into this world by choosing the lesser good, which is evil. When we do something less than what God has asked us to do, it's sin. We think in terms of gradations. Okay, this is really bad and this is not good, but it's not really bad. Well, when we do what God has not asked us to do, the lesser good, yeah, I believe that is sin. He that knoweth to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. Sin is the absence of good. Evil is the absence of good. I asked this question, but I want to talk just a little bit about it. Why did God not make us robots who could do only good? Why did he? Selfishly, I can make a case that that would have been mine. I would have voted God do that. But it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for some obvious reasons. God wanted us to love him, to glorify him, to praise him. And you can't have love without the freedom not to love. You can't have love without the freedom. You can have obedience, but you cannot have love. I love my wife, and that only has meaning because it's possible for me not to love her. You love one another, but that only has meaning because it's possible for you not to love. If I had no choice, if I was hardwired to where I had to love her, that takes the opportunity not to love her out of it, which takes the meaning out of love. And that's why I believe God did not make us robots. Because it takes the meaning out of life. You can obey, but you can't love without free will. and God wants both. Obedience without free will is called slavery in its most confining sense. Now, I know the Bible talks about us being slaves to the Lord, but that's still a choice. Ultimate slavery in this world, you don't have a choice. You obey. Our kids, when they're little, they obey, maybe, because they don't have a choice. Or if they do have a choice, there are immediate consequences. And that gets into how we choose to discipline our children, and I may or may not talk about that next week. But I think we do our children a great disservice when they don't understand what discipline is. But that may be me talking. Well, it is me talking. It may be my age talking. How can one will or do evil if there is no evil to do? This is back to Adam and Eve or to Lucifer. There was no evil. How could he do evil? How could Adam and Eve do evil when there was no evil to do, or if there was no evil to do? Really, that comes to the question, where or how did the first evil occur? And I've kind of alluded to this, but I'm going to go ahead with this before we take our break. Evil arose, I believe, when a good creature, Lucifer, or the angels or man, with the good power of free will, which I believe is good, willed the finite short-term good of the creature over the infinite good of both the creature and the creator. Now let me back up and make sure that at least I'm able to say what I want that to say. The creatures were created good. They were given good free will, so where did all this, how did evil come? It came when Lucifer and then Adam and Eve on this earth decided to take a short-term good. Adam and Eve wanted the fruit. Maybe they were hungry. That's a short-term, myopic good. At the expense of what was going to be long-term good for them and God's desires. Whenever we put our short-term ahead of our long-term, we're on dangerous grounds, and that's really what sin is. The scripture says what sin is, pleasure for a season. It's a short-term oomph. It's a opium. It's a short-term thing. So I think evil occurred when God's creatures, be they angels or man, put the short-term ahead of the long-term. I think you and I sin when we put the short-term ahead of the long-term. I don't know how many individuals I have counseled with or talked to that are, for instance, having marital problems, and I tell them, you will regret this, if they're talking about splitting. You will regret this in a few years, and invariably they do. Now, it's hard to sometimes get the horse back in the corral, but they're looking short-term rather than long-term. That second chocolate brownie, that's short-term, not long-term. By the way, and I had a slide, I decided not to use it. Chocolate comes from cocoa. Cocoa comes from a tree. Therefore, chocolate is salad. The end. Okay? But isn't that the way we rationalize and think? It's easy for us to wag our finger and say, how could people believe this? And then we go right out and at least emotionally or logistically do things that really are on the same premise. Okay, we are at 9:45. You have 15 minutes. Charles will address you the next hour, and then we'll be back with you. Thank you.